Israel says it opposes any U.S. understandings with Iran that would unfreeze Iranian funds in return for Tehran restraining nuclear activity. We'll get an Israeli journalist's perspective on those potential understandings.
And this is something that Israel's officials really say it's the most dangerous deal there is, because Iran gets everything but keeps also everything.
Plus, an Iranian-American activist group ends an unusual protest outside the State Department. We ask what they achieved. And Iran's president wraps up a rare visit to Latin America. A Wilson Center analyst tells us why the U.S. should be concerned.
There's no transparency in these relationships. They're by definition clandestine. What is happening in terms of terrorist financing?
From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Iran. Good morning. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. The U.S. State Department has responded to news reports of indirect talks between U.S. and Iranian officials in recent weeks by saying it has the ability to deliver messages to longtime U.S. foe Iran when such messages are deemed in the U.S. interest. State Department spokesman Matthew Miller told reporters in a June 13th briefing that a vast majority of U.S. media reports about purported U.S.-Iranian deals or diplomatic negotiations related to Iran's nuclear program were either wrong or completely misleading. He also reiterated that the U.S. is committed to ensuring Iran does not obtain a nuclear weapon and believes diplomacy is the best way to accomplish that. Tehran says its nuclear activities are peaceful. It also calls for the destruction of key U.S. ally Israel, which sees a nuclear-armed Iran as an existential threat. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu told a Sunday cabinet meeting that Israel opposes even the most limited nuclear understandings between the U.S. and Iran. Amichai Stein is a journalist with Israel's Khan Network. I asked him on the phone what he has heard from his sources about U.S.-Iran communication.
So the language of what is being discussed is the tricky part, because it's not a deal, it's not a signed document, but some kind of understandings between the two sides. And that's why the U.S. can deny that they're talking about a deal, but what's really been talking about is understandings. So Israeli officials understand and know that the U.S. is having indirect contact with Iran to reach these kinds of understandings. Again, it's not a signed document. It's something very verbal and something vague that each side can say, oh, we really didn't reach a deal. It's just something to put down the pressure, to put down the tension, so Iran cannot reach the 90% threshold of enriching uranium. Each side really is looking to say it's not a deal, but something really vague.
What are Israeli officials telling you, you know, privately about how they feel regarding this type of understandings that the U.S. is trying to reach with Iran?
So Israel always said that this kind of the deal is the most dangerous deal there is, because at the end, Iran can keep everything, gets economic benefits, and some would say it gives her some kind of immunity from a possible Israeli action against its nuclear sites. So Israeli officials always looked at this deal as something sometimes more dangerous than the JCPOA agreement, because the JCPOA, Iran needs to take out some centrifuges. Iran needs to take out enriched uranium over 60, over 20%. So it needs to do active steps in its nuclear program. So it does go back in what it has. In this kind of agreement, Iran has the complete nuclear program, just clicks on the pause button. And this is something that Israel's officials really say it's the most dangerous deal there is, because Iran gets everything but keeps also everything.
Can I ask, why do those Israeli officials fear that Iran could have some kind of immunity as a result of these understandings from any action that Israel might take?
The feeling in Israel all the time was that if the U.S. signs or agrees to some kind of a deal with Iran, then Israel cannot do whatever it wants to attack Iran's program. This is an understanding in Israel or a belief in Israel. That's why you hear always Netanyahu saying, we will not be bound by any deal signed between the U.S. and Iran, because he means we can continue our actions. But I think it's more than that, because the assumption in Israel, although Israeli officials like to say we will attack Iran nuclear program if we feel they are going towards a bomb, that at the end they will need Americans. And if there's a deal between the Americans and the Iranians, it's harder to bring the U.S. into the table of a military operation. And that's why Israel feels that gives them some kind of immunity when the Iranians have a deal with the U.S.
How would you say that the U.S. and Israeli sides are communicating right now about this issue? I mean, is it your impression that the dialogue is cooperative and friendly, or is it filled with tension?
There is always the communications between Israeli officials and U.S. officials, Israeli National Security Advisor Tzachi Hanegbi and Ron Dermer, Strategic Minister, talks a lot with the Americans. But at the end, Israeli officials say, we feel that the decision has been made in D.C. that the U.S. wants to go towards this agreement, that Israel has a very limited option on the table to take the U.S. outside of this view that they need a deal. So there is conversation. You know, Israeli officials tell their colleagues in the U.S., don't sign the deal. It's a bad deal. Don't do it. But the assumption in Israel, they can't really do anything to stop the deal if the Iranians come and say yes.
Well, if it comes to Israel exercising a military option against Iran, which is something Israel has long said it is willing to do, how prepared is Israel militarily to go on its own?
So this is a big question, because Netanyahu always said before this term as prime minister that Israel is ready to strike Iran if Israel needs to strike Iran. But then came the Bennett Lapid government and claimed that they looked at what was being done in the past years during the Netanyahu first era regarding a possible strike against Iran. And they said, we found that it's impossible to strike Iran because Israel isn't prepared to do this. Now Netanyahu comes and says this is an all lie and we can do it together. I think at the end, no one in Israel really believes that Israel can do it by itself, meaning they can do it maybe by themselves, but they will need the Americans on their side. So we don't know how much prepared is the military to do it. We know there's always trainings. We know where Israel is making steps towards this option. But at the end, you know, we have a really big political conflict. Is Israel ready to do it or Israel is not ready to do it? And I think everyone's assumption is that the U.S. will need to be a part of it if this plan to strike the nuclear program goes ahead.
Well, Amichai Stein, diplomatic correspondent for Israel's Kan 11 news channel, joining us on the line from Jerusalem. Thank you for being with us on Flashpoint Iran.
Thank you very much.
Here in Washington, a group of Iranian-American activists staged a two-week sit-in outside a State Department entrance to urge the Biden administration not to reach any kind of agreement that would enable Iran's Islamist rulers to access frozen funds abroad. Members of the National Solidarity Group for Iran set up a protest canopy and signs on a sidewalk just a few meters from the entrance on June 3rd, saying they were peacefully exercising their U.S. constitutional right to free speech while leaving space for people to walk by, as required by police. Siamak Aram was one of the organizers of the unusual sit-in, which concluded last Friday. I caught up with him at the site on that final day and asked how State Department staff reacted to his group's message.
As I was explaining, at the first few days, it was not clear for everyone, what's happening, why are they here,
why are you here?
Yeah. And for example, some of them talk, it's probably is part of the event here, it's a festival or something like that, and then we put these signs here to make it clear for everyone why we are here. For example, two individuals from this building ask us, are you funded? Are you, I mean, any group or party are supporting you? And that was a good question, because it looks like the event or action like this needs a support or funds.
Well, people always want to know in this town, like, who's paying for this? What is their agenda? So what is your answer to that?
That's why we put it on our statement for ending this sit-in today. We are a bipartisan, unaffiliated, non-profit organization. We receive funds and support from the people, from our members. So we have a GoFundMe on our website and everything is clear there. We are not working and collaborating with any party, any group, or any political organization.
So once the State Department staff, once they understand the point you just made, how receptive are they to your message?
I believe it's very clear for this building now who we are, why we are here. And on the third day, on June 5th, we asked to get into the building for a meeting with the director of Iran desk. And we had a conversation. We had a meeting. They wanted us why we are here.
So you got into the building?
Yes.
You were invited in. Can you share the name of the person you spoke to?
We wanted to keep this channel open for further conversation. That's why we have another meeting with them next week as well.
With the same person that you met?
With the same office and the same person.
Okay.
So at that meeting, I wanted to make sure that they know why we are here. And I questioned the reason behind this agreement, the conversation, negotiation they have, because while the regime in Iran, they keep oppression on people of Iran and people are fighting against them, why you are helping them? Why you wanted to release some funds to them?
Well, I'm sure the State Department, this administration, the Biden administration would say, well, we're not trying to help the Iranian government repress its own people. They're trying to use diplomacy to reduce the threat of Iran developing a nuclear weapon, and to use diplomacy to try to address Iran's other malign behaviors. So is this the kind of response that you got from them? And what do you think about that?
At the first meeting we had, so there were some rumors and we had some sources that they are going to do that. They're going to release some funds. They didn't accept and they didn't reject it at that meeting.
So the speculation going around is that the United States might unblock some money that Iran has locked up in different banks around the world.
Yeah, but they didn't accept that news at that day. But we knew that it's going to happen, and it happened.
Are you referring to the money, almost $3 billion,
exactly,
that Iraq owed to Iran in relation to their energy agreements?
Correct. And I questioned that as well. Since they didn't approve or accept it at the first meeting we had, I question how you make sure that they're not going to violate the sanctions and they will not have access to the actual money. And they said, we're not accept that it's going to happen. We make sure that we follow all the items related to the sanctions.
So you're obviously concerned that any money Iran gets from other countries could be used for malign purposes rather than humanitarian purposes, which is something the U.S. is hoping for. You say you have another meeting coming up. What do you realistically hope to achieve from that?
Okay, first of all, based on the resources and the sources we have, it looks like this building, they use some other sources from diaspora, some lobbies or institute and organization that help Islamic regime to get these decisions. That's why we wanted to make sure they hear another voice. They hear what's happening in Iran. We believe they have no good analysis about the protesters in Iran. Actually, we believe they don't know them. And even they don't know the Supreme Leader and the IRGC as well.
What you're saying is quite a strong statement to say that the United States government, which clearly has a lot of resources, intelligence resources, you're trying to make the point that they just don't know what's going on there.
That's why Obama apologized from his actions and decisions during the Green Movement in Iran in 2009. The same thing is happening right now. And we pushed hard and we will continue to do that to make sure they will hear our voices and concerns as well.
Well, just to finish up here, as you and your counterparts prepare to pack up this little tent sit-in that has been right outside the State Department for 2 weeks, what are your feelings about how this whole project went?
I believe that was successful. That was the first time a group like us actually did something like this. And also we pushed to make a communication connection with them. We know that some other groups and individuals try to meet them, try to communicate with this building, and especially Iran's desk. And there was no success and luck for that. But now we wanted to keep this channel open, keep our conversation, and inform them about what's happening in Iran, what's happening in diaspora. And we believe they monitor, because they told us they read all, they monitor all our statements, our social media accounts. So they know us and they know what are our concerns. But we wanted to make sure they hear us from this close to this building.
Well, it seems like your message did get through again on this occasion. Siamak Aram with the National Solidarity Group for Iran, thank you very much for speaking with us on Flashpoint Iran.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Iran. I'm Michael Lippin. Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi returned to Tehran on Friday after a rare 5-day tour of Latin America. He visited three countries that share the Islamic Republic's antagonism toward the U.S., stopping first in Venezuela and then traveling to Nicaragua and Cuba. Like Iran, they have all been heavily sanctioned by the U.S. for alleged malign behaviors. During his visits, Raisi signed agreements to boost cooperation with Venezuela, Nicaragua, and Cuba in various fields, and joined their leaders in denouncing the U.S. for sanctioning their governments. Cynthia Arnson is a Latin America analyst at the Wilson Center in Washington. I asked her by phone what message Raisi was trying to send with his regional tour.
I think there are multiple audiences. The first one and the most important one is a domestic audience in Iran, to show the Iranian public that Iran, despite the efforts of the United States, of the West, to isolate the country, it still has friends and allies and is capable of visiting far beyond Iran's shores, far beyond the Middle East. There's also, I think, clear messaging to the international community and to the United States in particular that Iran will show up in the Western Hemisphere, which pejoratively for decades, if not centuries, has been referred to as the backyard of the United States. It's nothing of the sort, but it clearly is the Western Hemisphere in which, you know, the United States is located. So I think there's also a kind of thumbing their nose at the U.S. politically. And then, you know, we can talk about what it means in strategic or security terms, which is a whole other dimension.
Well, I would like to get into that. Beyond the symbolism of Raisi sort of thumbing his nose at the United States by traveling around the Americas, how does his presence there, how does Iran's relationship with these three countries potentially hurt the U.S. and its security interests?
Well, there are multiple ways. In the economic sphere, the countries that the president of Iran has been visiting are all heavily sanctioned by the United States. Nicaragua, perhaps less, in that there are not across-the-board economic sanctions. In Venezuela, there are financial sanctions, there are oil sector sanctions. And Iran has been very critical to the oil industry in Venezuela in terms of helping to repair oil installations that have been ruined, basically, by mismanagement, by corruption, by thievery. And Iran has also been able to deliver to Venezuela at different times inputs such as food, gasoline, things that are in very short supply within Venezuela. So Iran has provided to Venezuela a lot of advice and assistance in evading U.S. sanctions. Iran has had to survive by learning what to do via turning off transponders, having ship-to-ship transfers.
With its oil tankers.
Of oil tankers, and it has helped Venezuela master some of those dark arts. And there are ways in which Venezuela has also assisted Iran in that some of the food shipments, for example, during the pandemic were paid for with gold. Venezuela has gold mining facilities. A lot of them are controlled by organized criminal groups, the ELN insurgency in neighboring Colombia. But that was cash in the bank for the Iranian regime. But let's get back to the other dimension of what this might mean in strategic terms for the United States. And in answering that or addressing that issue, I'd like to dial back to the early and mid-1990s when the government of Iran was credibly accused of helping to organize and mastermind and finance two terrorist bombings that took place in Argentina in 1992 of the Israeli embassy in Buenos Aires, and then several years later of the Jewish community center known as the Amia. So, you know, there's no transparency in these relationships. They're by definition clandestine. What is happening in terms of terrorist financing, opening pathways for Hezbollah and other movements to launder money or have a presence in the countries that are hostile to the United States and which have very complicated relationships with the United States.
Well, John Kirby, the U.S. National Security Council spokesperson, was telling the media at the start of Raisi's Latin American tour that the U.S. essentially is observing and monitoring what's going on, but is not going to be telling this or that Latin American country whom you can and cannot invite to visit you. What is your impression of how the Biden administration is responding to this at least symbolic challenge that Raisi is making by touring the region?
My sense is that there is not much of a response. These are not governments that are, let's just say that they are not open to suasion by the United States on almost any matter, particularly not with respect to who their foreign policy partners and allies are. I think what does and should concern the U.S. government is precisely these kinds of clandestine relationships or military or security relationships that we have seen, for example, develop between China and Cuba, according to the Biden administration, going back to the Trump administration. So this first emerged as an important issue under the government of Ahmadinejad in the mid-2000s.
The former Iranian president.
Exactly. The former president of Iran, who made common cause with the former president of Venezuela, Hugo Chavez. And Chavez saw both countries as, in his words, you know, gladiators of anti-imperialism, and then facilitated contacts between the former Iranian president and other left populist slash authoritarian governments in the region, including Bolivia. But you also have to remember that the biggest trading relationship that Iran had at the time, and I haven't looked at the trade figures recently to know if this is continuing, is with Brazil, which is an electoral democracy. It had at the time and has now a return of a government of the left. And I think the Biden administration recognizes that Latin American countries, including countries that are allies of the United States, want to pursue an independent foreign policy. What's said behind closed doors, I'm sure, is some degree of displeasure and attempts to discourage these kinds of relationships from going very far. But the U.S. ability to actually insist with Latin American governments, including allies, that they not have these relationships, I think, is limited. But you also have to remember, there are a lot of countries where the Iranian president is not welcome. And you look at the major South American economies, Mexico, Chile, Argentina, Peru, Ecuador. I mean, it would be a mistake to view the Iranian government as having the luxury of having extensive ties to Latin American countries.
So we got to put all that into perspective. Cynthia Aronson, distinguished fellow at the Wilson Center and former director of the Wilson Center's Latin America program, speaking to us from the DC area. Thank you so much for coming on to Flashpoint Iran.
Thank you for the invitation.
That's it for this week's show. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. Thanks for listening, and I hope you'll join me again next week for another Flashpoint Iran.